In a recent article for WisContext, our next guest fact-checked a state lawmaker's claim about rural school funding in the last state budget. The reporting led her to the Kickapoo School District, where there's only 3 students for every square mile. Nina Bertelsen is a student journalist and news manager at the Daily Cardinal, a student newspaper at UW-Madison. She's with us now to talk about that piece. Nina, thanks for joining us.
Hi, it's great to be here.
Well, this look at a particular school district, it started off as a fact check, right, about a claim about school funding made by a state senator. So what was that claim? How did you dig into it?
Yeah, so State Senator Janet Buley from Ashland claimed that sparsity aid funding from the proposal in the state budget to what was actually signed to the state budget was cut by about 2/3. And then the plan to make up for it, which was Senate and Assembly bill set that was signed into law, only made up for part of it. So kind of diving into that, we found that that was mostly true. It was a little bit off in her estimate, but that was mostly true. And so then I decided to follow up and try to get in contact with a small school district to see what sparsity aid impact actually has for them.
And that took you to the Kickapoo School District. Can you talk about some of the budget challenges that you found there?
Yeah, definitely. So Kickapoo was one of the few that actually called me back, so I was very grateful for that. So their superintendent was wonderful and spoke to me about some of their challenges. Different from larger school districts that have more students, they can kind of consolidate their costs, have more kids in classrooms, and give more options. They have to kind of get creative and make choices, is how he explained it. So they combine their school psychologist with their special education coordinator, which is something that he mentioned and is in the article, and some of their extracurricular or elective classes, they don't have as many, they can't offer as many, or they combine them. So they have an agricultural food processing class, but they don't have kind of a family consumer science class. And so in that class, they learn how to do roasts and make kind of ice cream, and they kind of combine them that way. And so it was really, for them, about choices, but being able to still provide a high level of education for their students is something that he really emphasized.
Right, that seemed like a theme that kept coming back, the idea that, okay, we do have to make these tough choices, but we don't want to let kids down. We don't want them to have an inferior educational experience.
Yeah, definitely. And that the student that I talked to as well, Hannah, mentioned that, you know, there were benefits to small school districts. Because it's so small, you get to have kind of deeper relationships with teachers and classmates because your classes are so small. But, you know, that does mean that maybe you don't have some of the same offerings as other schools. So she mentioned that, you know, if she had wanted to go into STEM, she might not have had as many math, kind of higher math offerings in high school that some of her kids or some of her friends that came from larger school districts had when they came to Madison. So, you know, trade-offs.
Another challenge we hear sometimes from smaller school districts who need this, who rely on the sparsity aid, is that they have trouble attracting teachers. They can't pay as much as a bigger district. They might not be able to offer as many amenities for a teacher who might want to move to a bigger community. Was that something you found in the Kickapoo School District, too?
Yeah, that's something that their superintendent mentioned, but something that he also emphasized was that it's about finding the right fit. And so a lot of their teachers have been around for a long time and are really invested in the community. And that it's, you know, if they have a teacher that comes in that, you know, doesn't really want to stick around in a rural school district for a long time, that maybe that isn't the best fit. And so he mentioned that they've been really lucky to have teachers that have stuck around for a long time, and they have really been able to find the right fit where the teachers want to be in their school district, and that even though it's smaller, and they really want them because they're able to provide an education. So kind of about finding matches was how they balanced that, he really emphasized.
Bringing it back full circle, you started off looking at sparsity aid for school districts. Did people at the Kickapoo District talk about how important that sparsity aid is in their efforts to do all the stuff we just talked about?
Yeah, so, you know, the superintendent, Doug Olson, definitely mentioned that, you know, it was a welcome benefit, and it helps them do different things around their schools, whether it helps them provide a more competitive pay and benefits package to their teachers, or it helps them. Some school districts will use it for building repairs, that it is something that, you know, they do use, and it does help them stay more competitive, was something that he said.
Nina, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Great. Thank you so much.
That was Nina Bertelsen, student journalist and news manager at UW-Madison's newspaper, The Daily Cardinal. Mike Wagner joins us now to talk about the student fact check program that's published online at the Observatory. Mike's an associate professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at UW-Madison. Mike, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Well, the Observatory was the origin point for Nina's story there. Tell us about why you're getting students involved in this fact-checking exercise.
Right. So the Observatory is a Baldwin, Wisconsin idea grant funded project that was hatched by me and my colleague Lucas Graves. And we have seen, and Lucas's research is about fact-checking in journalism, and we have seen this growth in fact-checking and less so at the local level. And we thought, you know, with these kind of the decreasing size of newsrooms in covering state government and state politics, there really should be a group of journalists dedicated to fact-checking things that our politicians say and other political elites say. And so we got this grant and started this website, the observatory.journalism.wisc.edu. And we teach it as a class where students learn how to do fact-check journalism. They are assigned lawmakers. We assign an equal number of Republicans and Democrats to students. They fact-check claims that they make in the public domain. They rate them based on what we call the Veritas scale, which is Latin for truth. And after the students do their work and they get feedback from me, then they go through the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism's fact-checking process with their managing editor, Dee Hall, because the last thing we want to do on a fact-checking site is get a fact wrong. And so we go through a kind of a two-stage process before we put anything up on the web.
How do you pick an accessible fact? I mean, because there could be sort of generic claims like Wisconsin is the best it's ever been or the worst it's ever been. You need a verifiable claim, right?
Exactly. And this is a huge controversy in the fact-checking world, which is why it's been so great to work with Lucas Graves, who's one of the experts on planet Earth about this stuff. Some places like PolitiFact will say we're going to only take claims that are absolutely checkable. You know, our economy grew by 3% since I became governor. Stuff like that, where you can say, well, okay, when did the person become governor? How did the economy grow? Let's weigh in on whether that's true. Other kinds of claims are murkier. They're more specific than Wisconsin's the greatest state in the country, right? There are things like one we recently did where the governor called small businesses, like one in particular that he was talking about, the backbone of the economy because they provide family wages. And so those aren't precise claims, but there's still things we can try to check. And so we had a student fact check that claim, talked to a lot of experts about, well, what does it mean to be the backbone of an economy? What percentage do small businesses contribute to the state economy? And what are the wages that those people who work in those small businesses earn? And so most fact-checking organizations will either rate claims on some truth scale or just provide a story. We'll rate them or we'll call them unobservable, which is to say, here's what we can tell you about it, but we can't tell you precisely whether it's true or false because the claim was too vague.
It seems like one common theme in your fact-checking with the students and any fact-checking operation is, you know, the words we dreaded to hear from the high school math teacher, show your work.
Right.
And so there is the explanation of how you assess the claims, not just the ultimate rating.
Right. We take the reader through, here's every part of the claim we're checking. Here's every piece of data or interview we use to get that. We provide hyperlinks to everything for which there's a document for. We list the interviews and the people we talk to at the bottom of every story. So anything that we used to weigh in on the veracity of a claim, the reader could do themselves, or at least could retrace our steps.
If you fact check my claim, and I don't like, and you said, what, Rob, no, you were way off there. Do I get to weigh in? Do I get to say, here's what I meant, here's why I think I'm right?
Yes. Our step one is contact the person who made the claim and ask, what did you mean by that? And where did you get the information you used to make that claim? Sometimes people get back to us. Sometimes they don't. Sometimes they get back to us well into the process and say, oh, what I really meant is something that maybe sounds a little bit self-serving. But we tend to take people at their word and say, if that's what you meant, we'll try to check that. But we'll also tell a more contextual story about what other people might have interpreted that claim to mean and whether those interpretations are true as well.
We've talked to your colleague Lucas Graves on the show about this rise of fact-checking. Why fact-checking? Why now? Why has this become such a big thing all of a sudden?
Well, part of it is just the media ecology that we live in, where people can choose for themselves to listen, read, watch places that just tell them that their side is right and the other side is wrong. And we need sources that don't have an ideological stake in the game to say, we have done an investigation to see whether this claim is true or this claim is false. And knowing whether our leaders are saying things that are true or false, or only true under some circumstances or only false under some circumstances, are important for us to know as we make our decisions about whether we want to rehire these people on Election Day.
Does fact-checking inform other kinds of reporting now?
I think it does. There's a little bit of evidence that politicians who get fact-checked become a little bit more careful in how they speak publicly about things, having been through that process, and especially if the result is it was not a good one for them. There's some evidence that fact-checking can help individuals understand what's true. There's also evidence that people read fact checks and double down on their own partisan beliefs regardless of what the fact check says, or will attack the fact checkers themselves. And there's a lot of folks who attack different organizations out there by saying they're ideologically motivated in one way or another.
Fact checking is potentially very time consuming,
yep.
Labor intensive from a journalism perspective.
It is.
Newsrooms in many cases are smaller now than they used to be, and getting smaller in many cases. Is this sustainable?
It's difficult. Usually what the local outfits have done have been like ours, which is grant funded, or something like the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel does, where they partner with PolitiFact, and maybe there's one or two people who are dedicated to doing the fact checking while their other journalists do the things that journalists do, cover the State House, cover the arts, cover education, all those sorts of things.
Is fact checking now a key part of any up-and-coming journalist's education?
I think it is. It's a place where jobs are growing. We place a lot of students in organizations like PolitiFact and other fact-checking outfits around the country, and it's something that readers like. It's something that journalists themselves, and that Lucas has shown in his own research, journalists believe it's prestigious and worth doing. It's something that audiences look for, which is good in the media models we find ourselves in economically right now, and so I think it's here to stay.
Mike, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
That's Mike Wagner, associate professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at UW-Madison. He's with us to talk about the student fact-check program there called The Observatory.